Hello, friends. It's your Chapo for this week. It's me, Will Menaker, back again. And I think I'll kick off this episode by reminding you that next week we'll be headed to the Midwest of the United States. So if you are in Pittsburgh on October 7th, come see us at Mr. Small's. If you are in Columbus on October 10th, come to the Athenaeum Theater to see us live on stage with Brett and Brian, Street Fight, Columbus Legends. If you are in Detroit, October 11th at the Majestic Theater. In Chicago at the House of Blues on October 14th. Madison, Wisconsin at the Barrymore Theater on October 16th. And if you are in Minneapolis on the 18th, the Cedar Cultural Center, we have just added a second early show. So if you want to buy tickets for our Minneapolis show, but they're sold out, go to chapotraphouse.com/tour to buy tickets for our newly added early show in Minneapolis. Again, all these tour tickets are available at chapotraphouse.com/tour. Okay, let's start the show. Hey, everybody. Like I said, it's Chapo. We're here. We're here for you. We're here with you, as we are all the time. We're coming off two, and one in particular, absolutely soul-destroying episodes. So I think we're going to take a bit of a break. We're not going to talk Supreme Court anymore. We've done about as much Brett Kavanaugh as I can stomach for one lifetime. In a little bit, we'll be having fun at the expense of Frank Bruni and Michael Bloomberg. But I'd be remiss if I didn't introduce our guest for this week. It is playwright, screenwriter, and now showrunner, but most importantly, friend of the pod, Elena Smith. Hi. Elena, how are you doing?
Very well. So happy to be here.
You're here with me, also Felix.
Hello.
Amber.
Hi.
And Matt.
Hey.
They're both back, folks. Everyone was saying, where's Amber and Matt? Where's Amber and Matt?
I'm here, folks.
This episode is for you.
Trouble your hearts no more.
So like I said, we're going to have a little fun this episode. And why don't we kick things off by engaging in some utterly baseless, unsourced, and spurious intergenerational sociological research. Let's get this generational fight going. Boom. Elena, what's the deal with Gen X and what is their problem?
I love that question. And I agree with not talking about Brett Kavanaugh, but I will only provide the one segue, being that Brett Kavanaugh is Gen X. And of course, his good friend Mark Judge wrote the book Wasted: Tales of a Gen X Drunk, which
Need
has
me say more.
Shoved Gen X back into our faces and made us all think about what does it mean to be Gen X?
He's basically Stephen Dorff from SFW. SFW, yes.
Now, for those not aware, Gen X refers to the generation that followed the baby boomers, and preceded millennials.
The curse of millennials.
So it basically stretches from about the 60s until 1980.
It's 1960 to 1980, and I think that the term Generation X was coined by Douglas Copeland
in
his
correct.
Book Generation X, but it's just funny because he picked the third to last letter of the alphabet. So like he started it off there, and that's why no one knows what happens now.
Well,
it's we've already
planning.
Gone through Y and Z, and now what do we do?
Generation Y refers to millennials.
Was supposed to be millennials.
And now the people who are after millennials are often referred to as Gen Z, which I think is actually very fitting because they will be the last generation of human beings on this planet.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Right.
Perfect.
Douglas Copeland knew that the world was only going to last two more generations. So that's why he started with X.
I think to get this story started, we have to start with the modern generations, using modern in the academic context. The greatest generation, the generation of World War II. These were all pill-popping psychos who got their brains ruined by Great Depression and war.
George Licker from Ren and Stimpy.
Yes. They spent their most formative young years, you know, eating dried out rats and fighting in the trenches of the Pacific and Western Europe. When they came home, they wanted their kids to have a better life than they could, but they had no way to express themselves. So they would just not talk to their young boomer children for months at a time, then come into their rooms at night sobbing their eyes out, saying that they're beautiful and no one could ever say no to them because they remembered their friend getting killed or something, or their daughter, their younger brother being sold to a farmer. And the boomers, having no access to
Felix thinks all of the Greatest Generation were like traveling carnies.
You're also skipping.
Well, after between the Greatest Generation the and the Boomers generation. Is the generation that no one knows what it is.
The silent
which is
generation.
The silent
they all died. R.I.P.
Okay, Mad Men. That's
so
all I know.
Boomers,
about
but but Felix is correct. Carney was the YouTube star of the Greatest
Generation. Exactly. So Boomers grew up with this psychotic sense of entitlement, but a complete emotional stuntedness from their alcoholic and morose parents. This manifested in an utter terrorization of service workers throughout the ages that was made possible by their unnaturally high wages and wealth that has not been enjoyed by a generation thereafter. The children of the boomers, the immediate children of the boomers, the Gen Xers.
Wait, I thought the millennials were the children of the boomers.
No, it's
Gen X.
Gen X, yeah.
Well, it depends.
Well, my parents, I'm millennial. My parents are
boomers.
Are boomers, but most people breed younger than my parents.
I'm older than
my type
I'm older
of parents.
Than Felix.
Well,
and
this
my
is
mom
why
is Gen
talking
X.
about yeah. generations is like fundamentally
because
classist.
He's Jewish, and that's how they do
well,
it.
Well, I'm doing it for the most people. Most okay. Jews have their first kids at the average age of 63. So
it's more practical.
Yeah, it makes a lot more
not
sense. You have your life figured out then. You only get a lot of birth defects.
That's why Felix is so great.
That and just like, you know, inbreeding hundreds of years ago. Okay, you know, it's fine.
So,
but
it brings us to Gen X.
Gen X,
no matter who spawned them, they're here right. and we'd have to deal with them.
Gen X has.
One of them will soon be on the Supreme Court.
Gen X have a lot of the psychotic entitlement that boomers have, like a lot of it, but they know enough that they should feel bad about it. But they have enough boomer in them to never do anything about it. Just believing that feeling bad is its own punishment, which makes them more than boomers, the most American generation.
Well, okay, so I was thinking about Gen X today because I knew that we were going to talk about Gen X, and I didn't have that many interesting thoughts, but I did think, first of all, that Gen X they're the youngest old people. Like, mm-hmm. that's the thing about them, because they come about and they're known for being like alternative and slackers and sort of like they're not boomers. They're younger and cooler than boomers. But then all the things that defined them as cool immediately disappeared and like technology moved on. And now they just don't belong in the world again, but from the other way.
Right.
Right. I think that boomers and the Gen Xers, it's almost like the tortoise and the hare, because you see the boomers all grew up. They were in gangs, but they were gangs of white people that sang songs. They all listened to songs by like Joey Popsicle Stick called "Oh Sweetie Baby." Let's go to the train tracks.
There were all songs about how at least a third of your high school class died in auto accidents.
Exactly. Yeah. They had their first kid at age 17 when they fucked their sweetheart in a big car, and they made the equivalent of $250,000 a year mining a candy store. And
Gen Xers.
So it's like they wouldn't seem cool compared to the Gen Xers who as kids, you know, tied flannel shirts around their waist. Awesome.
Yes.
So but as time goes on, who is taking technology better? Boomers. Because they're so entitled that they caught up, and now look at what a boomer does online. They're anti-mod.
So I think when I think of any kind of, and obviously this is completely baseless.
Totally baseless.
But,
all of this.
So don't fucking email us. I love my mother.
Email
like
Virgil.
The character kind of case study that I look at for Gen X is Reality Bites as the first sign of rapidly diminishing expectations, right? Because you can either have Ethan Hawke or Ben Stiller, and those are the only two guys.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, those are the only two guys, and they both suck.
Yeah.
And that's basically when they started to say, okay, the world is not your oyster. You got to pick one of these terrible two choices. It's the post-Fukuyama view of romance.
Well, yeah, and compare that to
it's the end of history. It's the end of romance.
Compared to the equivalent boomer film, which is The Graduate, where a guy gets everything he wants, and he's like, oh, I feel like shit.
And he's just miserable, yeah.
Well, but also, this is another thing about Gen X, is that Reality Bites is the perfect example, because it's like, okay, Reality Bites, it's cool. They're saying, they're using slang to talk about reality. They're being like somewhat meta. Things are in quotes. They're sort of disaffected. And yet it's completely heteronormative. It's completely focused on white people.
He's gay.
What happens to him?
But there is like a brief moment of his like coming out story. And then they're like, ah, you're not that important.
What happens to Steve Zahn in that movie?
I've never seen it.
I mean, it focuses heavily on the most narcissistic people in the movie. Like, you don't hear as much about Janine Garofalo. Remember when she got Winona Ryder a job at The Gap? And she's like, I'm not going to work at The Gap. And it's you're a bitch.
This is the other massively Gen X thing, is the obsession with selling out, right? That's what defines them. It's like, they don't want to sell out. But they also define themselves by a series of like cultural jobs that no longer exist in any form for anyone to get paid doing, like such as magazines. Getting paid to be part of a magazine is just not even a thing anymore.
Right, and also the idea that they're too good for a real job, when in fact we all hear, as most of us millennials or at least straddlers know, that the only reason we have this job is because we're too bad for real jobs.
Yeah. Gen Xers be like,
we're useless.
Gen Xers be like, damn, can't wait to become a travel agent in 2018.
Well, that's, I think, what's so sad. Like, I feel that the Gen X figure is like, at this point right now, is just a truly lost soul. Because like the boomers, they've had their fun, you know, like they really did rule the world and continue to rule the world. And they've like sucked it dry and eaten everything off the bone and like fully exhausted their appetites upon this earth. But like Gen Xers never came into their own. And then now it's just moved on without them. Like
their first decline in kind of what you could expect in the expectations of youth. Their parents thought, oh, we could rebuild the world. And they're thinking, oh, the world is shit and we're definitely not going to rebuild it. But maybe I can have like a little piece of something pure and authentic
whatever. They're obsessed with authenticity.
Yeah.
And now they don't understand young people, because young people don't even have a concept of that.
I remember asking when I taught my students, if I thought something was real or not, or if it mattered because some author had, you know, like embellished their life story or whatever. I think I was teaching like Hunter S. Thompson or whatever. I'm like, so this part is kind of made up, and like Hunter S. Thompson did that a lot. I'm like, do you think that matters? And they were like, no. That's so, you would not get that response, I think, from Gen Xers.
Yeah, no. Yeah, you're right. Authenticity is what matters. And
they're very awkward about social media.
Yeah, because it all is very, the whole internet culture is so brazenly and intentionally false.
Yes.
On its face, it's like they're short-circuiting robots.
It's also brazenly like looking for attention. Mm-hmm. There's no shame about that. Mm-hmm. And that's like a deeply like anti-Gen X concept, because you're supposed to wear your flannel shirt and like stand in the corner of the room and not care.
The patron saint, Kurt Cobain.
Right.
It's like, I'm famous, but I hate it. Stop looking at me.
Right.
You know, I mean, another thing that I've noticed about Gen X, and I guess this is the story of all generations, basically, like similar to the way baby boomers who went to Woodstock and followed the dead around all became Reagan voters.
Yeah.
You know, like I think of that John Mackey Whole Foods asshole.
Yes,
like,
exactly. Mm-hmm.
You know, and like with Gen X, I feel like there's a similar rightward, drift with a lot of these people, in that, like, again, they think that they're authentic and cool. And then like at some point in their, you know, mid-30s, knock on wood from saying that for myself, they stop being cool and relating to kids. And like they weren't the cool rock and roll guy that they fantasized about as a kid. And they got very angry and bitter as a result of that. And look no further than Bart O'Kavanaugh and Judge Holden.
Yeah, and Brett Kavanaugh talked about Fast Times at Ridgemont High, like, in his testimony. And, like, he talked about that as, like, we would have fun. We would watch Fast Times at Ridgemont High. But the thing is that if you go and watch that movie or any 80s movie that these teenagers were watching, like, they're unbelievably, like, racist and misogynist films. So it's sort of, like, fake
I don't know. The idea of it.
I don't know.
Being...
You brought up Fast Times at Ridgemont. Hey, Amber, you brought up that there is an abortion in that movie.
Did he just not see that part?
But not only is there an abortion in that movie, Jennifer Jason Leigh gets an abortion and it's fine.
It was
the right decision. Like,
yeah,
and that's
she was like stressed because whoops.
That's interesting.
But yeah, it was like kind of, I think people just remember Spicoli, but there was a whole abortion thing.
Yeah. Hmm. Hard to say what will become of us millennials. You know, I hope we can avoid the similar.
But millennials are also.
We deserve to get wiped out by Gen Z. We deserve it.
We are
a cancer on this culture. I want Gen Z to issue a great cleansing wrath.
I also
cultural
don't know
revolution.
What we mean by millennials anyway. Like there's different kinds of millennials. And like I was born in 1980, so I just am the cusp of Gen X and millennial. But I identify more. Well, once I heard the term Xennial, I really felt seen for who I was.
I think we should divide millennials.
But millennials are already old.
I think we should divide millennials between the people who identify with the golden age of The Simpsons and watched it while it was on TV.
True. Yes.
And those and those who liked South Park and Family Guy.
That makes sense.
Two cohorts of millennials.
Yes.
Yes.
However, I just said I wasn't going to become a reactionary, but I 100% disagree with Felix. These Gen Z weirdos are all glowing-eyed psychopaths.
Oh, God, terrifying.
And I want nothing to do
with
them.
All they do is play murder simulators
day long. They want the internet. They want to return to when we were truly great. They want a return to the internet being mean again. They want blood back in video games. They want farts back in movies. Millennials are just a younger type of Gen X.
Felix is just the guy in the Trans Am doing circles around the high school parking lot right now.
A very Gen X thing is that there was once, I think, a PBS special called Cool Hunting that was hosted by Douglas Copeland. And it was about the way that before the internet, people in advertising had to go on the hunt for cool. And there was studies of how something that was trending in New York would only show up in Austin like 5 years later, because that's how long it took to get on like the Pony Express, like one trend from a city to another.
Thomas Frank wrote about this with the conquest of cool too. Yeah,
but now there is no cool.
Right. Well,
how could you go
I've
find
talked
cool?
about this
What's
with
cool?
the friends of mine who also grew up in like, you know, flyover America. And one of my friend Jen, shout out to Jen Pan, said, I went back to Idaho, and she's like, and all the girls look like NYU students. She's like, there's no, like, it's all homogenized.
That's
now
right.
Because of the internet.
That's right.
And she's like, and it's a little sad.
From what, the only thing I can gather from what I've observed is that cool is murdering your friend on Instagram Live. That seems to be it.
I mean,
what
that
isn't
is cool
about that.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I'm searching for what could give that sense of danger. I think Gen Xers did have authentically things that were dangerous because you still had...
Yeah, like heroin.
Yes.
Got out of hand.
Gen X was like the first generation associated with a kind of ironic detachment kind of like an alienated indie sensibility.
Yes.
But I think now that they've all gone into middle age, they've become carelord reactionaries who are like, I don't know, got religion or care or lament the fact that there's no sincerity anymore.
Well,
and that disgusts me.
We're talking about, though, although there was also some kind of aloof, standoffish element to the ideal Gen X male, too. And we're talking about like white middle class, like the people who are supposed to represent the generation.
And male. Like it's always a shaggy
male.
White male. That's
very
what a
male.
Gen Xer is. Yeah.
But actually one of the things that I think we were kind of missing for a while that is sort of now coming back is, and it went into cynicism, but at the time I think it was a healthy skepticism, and it was like, oh, people are trying to sell you things and they're not your friends. Companies are not your friends. Brands are not your friends. Woke advertising should have died in its crib. But I think the kind of like retirement of that idea, and maybe the fact that people just got so sick of its ultimate conclusion, which is this Adbuster sanctimony, is that they'd left it all behind. But really, that is something we could use more of. It's just like, no, this company is not my friend. They're not anti-racist. They're not feminist. They're a company. They're selling a product.
Nothing makes me sicker than when I see a fucking fast food chain talk about depression. Shut the fuck up.
No, but
shut the fuck up. My God, bring me back the singing rats from Quiznos.
But also
over
advertising.
This.
But see, here's the thing. Advertising doesn't work anymore. Mm. And as a result, there's been a complete breakdown of like the centralized entertainment industry. And so I'm telling you right now that like within 5 to 10 years, all we will be watching, the only content, the only shows available to us will be like Nike soap opera. Right. And and I don't even know whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, because there have always been patrons of art and art needs patrons to exist. And like, I'm not saying that those shows are going to effectively sell Nikes. I just think it's going to be, you know, it's like everyone who works in advertising actually wants to be an artist, and everyone who's an artist needs to get paid. So the ultimate, you know, but again, it's that like total, you know, obsolescence of the notion of selling out. Like there's no such, there's no division anymore between, we just are brands, all of us.
But that's what happened is that Amber's right, is that there was that instinctive hostility to advertisers and brands. And then that went away. Now it's gone.
Well, like because it overplayed its hand. It got sanctimonious.
It led to fucking
Adbusters
because it was a dead end. Because it's like, all right,
It got co-opted by advertising itself.
Yeah, which anti-advertising became the new advertising.
I'm pretty sure I've mentioned this on the show before, but can I just say again, my single favorite spread in Adbusters magazine that I've ever seen? It was like a 2-page spread, and on one side was just like all the like logos of popular brands, like the Nike swoosh or like the Coca-Cola symbol, or you know the well-known advertising logos. And on the other page, it was just outlines of different kinds of leaves. And the copy at the bottom said, "There's something wrong when you can recognize everything on this side and nothing on the other."
Adbusters was so awesome.
Adbusters, so loud, guys.
Yeah, okay.
They're still selling
it's the only good magazine.
Well, this is because it was the Fukuyama era, and it was like, well, I guess capitalism won, so instead I guess we'll be anti-consumerist.
Yeah.
And that, of course, sucks because no one wants to live austerely. And also, they remember their baby boomer parents who remember their greatest generation parents who actually did live austerely, and it just made them into just blind psychopaths that couldn't connect with their family or spouses or whatever. But I got to go into my favorite Adbusters was one that has a like crinkled vodka bottle on it that's like crinkled and deflated, and it says absolute impotence, implying that you're not going to be able to get it up with vodka, which
that's whiskey that,
that would be
of.
The history of there are still Russians. I'm sorry. That's just not true.
Who's like paying for ad? But like, it's kind of amazing. For like 30 years, they've done the same magazines where it's like a car with pollution written on the side.
How many people do you think went from the Adbusters, like, you know, ad busting thing to actual ad agencies? It's probably a through line, right?
Yeah. Hundreds of thousands.
Well, that's the thing is that this is a cultural phenomenon that's sort of expands beyond any particular generation is that you get alienated from some cultural aspect of the current socioeconomic order.
A symptom.
And you basically, because you can't do anything about it, because collective action has been foreclosed, because you wouldn't even know how to start doing something like that, especially in the 90s, my God, you basically have a choice of you can either stop caring about it or deal with it or just be the most annoying person on earth that no one wants to hang out with.
Right.
And that's like you can either, it's like you're either the Adbuster guy that everybody rolls their eyes at or you just sort of get let the program.
I think going back to boomers a bit, I think of everyone talks about like boomer MAGA people, boomer Republicans.
Boomer magic.
But there were a lot of boomer liberals. And when I think about boomer liberals, I think about my dad. And he was a very specific type of liberal we don't have anymore. Which is guy who despises like the CIA, the military war, but doesn't know what to do about it. He doesn't have any like proper critique of it. So he's like, all right, I support Bill Clinton, you know, like, and I feel like the Gen Xers got a little bit of that because they correctly identified the problem that marketing was becoming the new language that defined all our interactions and all our interpersonal relationships and our relations with the world around us. But they didn't know what to do about it. So what they did about it was to make Adbusters.
Right.
Or to be like, check out my flannel.
Well, by that point, especially after like the World Trade Organization protests, there was no sense that like, well, what if the problem is actually capitalism? because they're like, well, this is done. This project is not going anywhere ever. So you just become either sanctimonious or, you know, again, jump on board.
Well, or like the dot-com boom, right? Which was which was like what's going to reinvent capitalism
they
in
would
this
use the
fresh
word revolution.
New way.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, and I guess, and that's the thing. It's like Gen X always had this air of revolution around it. But now that we stand on the cusp of Brett Kavanaugh, a wasted tales of a Gen X drunk, like going onto the Supreme Court to, you know, like dismantle labor and control women's bodies. Like it's pretty clear that there wasn't a revolution
there. Yeah. And, more of the same.
Yeah.
Black Spot shoe. Anyone remember this?
No. What's that?
Adbusters sold a shoe. It was supposed to be anti-brand shoe, and it had a big black splotch
on
it instead of a brand. It was called the Black Spot. I'm not kidding.
That's a logo.
That's
You're describing
thing.
A logo.
It's an anti-logo. That was a real thing you could really buy.
This
is
like people who say they're anti-ideological. It's like, no, that's an ideology.
I would say the same as like not dismantling capitalism. It's like they didn't dismantle patriarchy either. And all these Gen X heroes are white men. You know, it's like Kurt Cobain, like David Foster Wallace, like indie filmmakers of the 90s, like they're alt, like they're slouched over, they're like slackers, but they're still just white men taking up a ton of room and like in the and not like questioning their own identity as being like the story that most needs to be heard.
Well,
or the one that
the
others revolve around.
Right. The cult of the you know, sad young white man or whatever has remained like largely untouched. But the interesting thing about Kurt Cobain is that he was kind of, I mean, he was like best friends with Kathleen Hanna and shit, even though his wife punched her in the face. Anyone remember that? It's hilarious. You could tell he had this kind of, I mean, he wrote about it, I guess. He had this kind of cognitive dissonance about it, and he didn't really know what to do about it. He, you know, would do whatever feminist graffiti and stuff like that. But ultimately, that entire, at least grunge, you know, as kind of a movement or whatever, was commodified very quickly, and it wasn't in their hands who got heard. It wasn't like, you know, you were going to hear whatever L7 as much as you were going to hear Nirvana on the radio. And it wasn't necessarily the band's decision because it doesn't matter that it was like an organic thing that happened in Seattle with your friends in a garage. Ultimately, there are forces at play that are not in your control. And I think that must be kind of a frustrating thing. And now it's different. Now we have like SoundCloud and shit, I guess, but I don't know. It's just ultimately you're always going to run into this thing where art is not decided upon in any way that is democratic. And I'm not necessarily even saying that's a good thing because a lot of times people have terrible taste, but it's certainly not up to the artists themselves who gets famous or who gets recognition or who gets written about in the history books.
According to, you know, again, in conclusion, based on our highly researched and sociologically sound data points that we've presented, boomers, a scourge, Gen X, also bad.
Except my mom.
Millennials, mostly bad.
Jerry's out.
Other than me, a few people I know.
I'm going to be dignified and old. Gen Z, scary. Terrible.
Gen Z, little,
the
Lord's
exact thing
army
we need.
People. Awful.
Wonderful.
Babies
walking around
are
with
great.
Fucking, with fucking necklaces made of teeth. They're going to be the ones who just
you're making them
gnaw
sound much
the
cooler than they are.
They
you're
rule. You're right. They
much
rule.
Much cooler than they are.
They're going to be doing.
They aren't eating us now, but when
they're going to be doing the bone tomahawk to all of us.
Yes, exactly. They're going to be Gen dabbing over the corpses of their parents.
It's going to be so sweet when the last thing you hear is Yayeet.
I have no generational loyalties nor antipathies, except when I'm like, I don't know, in line somewhere and someone is writing a check for something still. But like, basically, when they're not when the generation is not inconveniencing me directly, I try to remember that I too will be old and irrelevant someday, and whatever. I'm going to be a podcaster. How embarrassing is that going to be? How am I going to explain that to my grandchildren? That is going to be humiliating.
You won't have it. We won't have those people.
But I guess that's the thing about Gen X is that they were irrelevant when they came onto the scene, and now they're irrelevant in like a whole new way, and that's what makes them very sad.
Well, how about we have some fun, guys? Okay. Let's have some fun with the New York Times op-ed page.
Yeah.
Woo! Okay. Woo!
Okay. So let's get these juices flowing, guys. Opinion. Is this man the antidote to Donald Trump? Maybe one super rich old white guy from New York can save us from another super rich old white guy.
Is that supposed to be like self-knowing, like tongue-in-cheek?
Yeah, of course. This is the Frank Bruni.
Okay.
It takes a billionaire to know a billionaire. What if it also takes a billionaire to take down a billionaire?
Wow. I've always said both those things.
I mean,
those two like common sentiments that it takes a billionaire to know a billionaire. Yeah, rolls off the tongue.
It's a billionaire in the bush is worth two billionaires in the hand.
It's the plot of every cop movie. You need a bad guy to catch a bad guy.
Coming this fall to Fox. Billionaire cop.
Frank Bruni
kills billionaires.
Frank Bruni writes with the grace of a overweight 13-year-old boy making his way onto the slow dance floor.
The thing I love
this sort of clunky, but just a little too self-aware, and it just makes everyone feel bad.
The best thing about Bruni is that that's supposed to be the most valuable intellectual real estate in American media, right? New York Times op-ed page. These people are talking, opining an audience of millions about politics. They shape the agenda of the day. And they just took a guy who spent his entire career going, wow, these ravioli are really fluffy, and said, hey, you can talk about politics. He's a fucking food critic. How did that happen?
I don't hate myself enough to actually do this, but I want to go back to Frank Bruni's old food columns.
I kind of do, too.
See if he's as dumb about food as he is about this.
I kind of do, too. I'm just curious. We should do that for a reading series at some point.
There's so many Franks.
There's so many Franks. It would be funny if there
was you go back there and the Bruni restaurant review is like, the food was great, but I was lost for 15 minutes trying to find the bathroom.
It's probably like similar harebrained ideas to his political concepts where it's like, you know, I think that Hardee's should make spaghetti.
It's gonna be,
okay.
It's gonna be like an entire column on him choking to death on a garnish.
You got Frank Bruni, Frank Rich, Frank Booth. Okay.
TV's Frank.
Thomas Frank.
There you go. That was the theory. Okay, so what if it takes a billionaire to take down a billionaire? That was the theory behind giving Michael Bloomberg a prime speaking spot at the Democratic National Convention.
And it worked! Yeah! It's like, don't you stop writing at that point! It's like, oh, right,
they lost. That's when it became relatable.
It's like, that's when everyone really clicked in. It didn't work. Never mind. My idea was stupid. I'll start over with a different one.
I mean, they lost because not enough people saw Michael Bloomberg's speech.
Right.
I mean, that's how little these guys give a shit. Like, this guy started writing, he got to that line, which any one of us with intellectual honesty would be like, oh, right, this invalidates my entire thesis. But he's like, well, I'm not opening a new Word document.
That was the theory, where his mockery of Donald Trump carried extra zing and sting.
It
again,
sure
it's like he's writing about food.
Yeah.
It was zesty and flavorful.
And he's right. I remember any line at all from that speech.
Yeah.
Can you remember a single word from the speech? Anyone?
I think
I'll tell my children where I was when I heard it.
I think he like at one point he was asking a valet to bring his car around. That's the only thing I remember.
He was like, he took out a experimental plasma rifle and just shot a big gulp out of somebody's hand. It was a memorable event, beloved by all.
And that's the idea. Well, one of the ideas behind Bloomberg's possible bid for the presidency in 2020. You didn't hear?
The only idea is just that he's an ego monster.
You didn't hear? It was a morsel of news. He's just feeding food. He's just eating.
It was a sumptuous little a moose boosh of information.
It was a morsel of news. He's like found an M&M in his couch. And he's like, oh, I'll be having that. I'll be turning that into a column today. Bloomberg is again thinking about running, and if he forges ahead, he'll compete for the Democratic Party's nomination. To the extent that people I know reacted to this, it was with a chuckle or an eye roll vigorous enough for corneal abrasion. What most of them said was some version of, oh great, that's just what voters want and America needs, another super rich old white guy from New York. But no two super rich old white guys from New York are exactly alike. And these two have little in common, including financially.
Incorrect.
One of them is a Jew.
The best thing about Michael Bloomberg, that he's richer than Donald Trump.
Listen to this next.
He invented a machine.
Listen to this next sentence, Felix. Trump's net worth, as mysterious as the Yeti, is estimated to be about $3 billion, while Bloomberg supposedly tops $50 billion.
I know that we're going to talk about how stupid this is, like what, like that every voter is going to be like, I'll take the richer guy, please. But can we just, I've kind of just two awful, awful, awful instances of Bruni's writing in like the past three sentences. One, rolling your eyes so much you get corneal abrasion. That like you roll happen. Your eye so fast that your eye starts bleeding.
Doesn't make sense.
It cuts open. Like yeah. What? And then as mysterious as the Yeti.
Yeah.
That's the grand mystery of the Yeti. Oh my God. This is so fucking bad. I know that like we're talking about how shitty his ideas are and how lazy he is, but he's just such a fucking bad
writer. As a writer, I really think it deserves reflection.
But it is also just like classic New York Times. Like this feels so far just like a social column. Like it feels like it's commenting on like society. It's right. Like, well, guess what I heard the other day over in, you know, East Egg is that Bloomberg might throw his hat in again, you know, and he's actually richer, much richer.
Yeah, it's always how his friends responded to it. They love that. Yeah.
Right.
By the way, Matt, as two people who have now visited the International Museum of Cryptozoology, I think we can state conclusively there is no mystery to the Yeti.
The Yeti is real.
It's a cryptid. He's real.
He's a real guy.
He's located in the mountains of Central Asia and elsewhere.
He's a simple beast that wishes to be left alone. It doesn't mean he's mysterious. He just enjoys his privacy.
The Bigfoot is a simple beast which wishes to be left alone. He's the North American version of the Yeti.
They're different.
The Yeti is a dangerous, violent, malevolent creature who should be hunted and destroyed.
He is more aggressive. Yeah. Also more
you guys
frequently
are going all jaws
goes on four
this.
Legs. As opposed to the Yeti, which is always bipedal, or the Bigfoot, which is always bipedal.
I feel like this is a really elaborated upon Chris Rock bit.
Oh my God, I was just going to do that. I was reaching for that. Like Ricky says, great minds think a lot.
It's the New York Times office. Frank Broody's like, I've got some information on the Yeti and the mystery behind it. And then it's just me raking my fingernails on a chalkboard. You want me to find the Yeti? I'll find him for you. Kill him. Stuff him. But it'll cost you $10,000.
Also, sometimes appears with horns, which is never true of Bigfoot.
Yes. The Yeti is a horned beast. Yeah. He's horny.
He's a horned beast.
He's horned up, folks.
He's a horny toad. Anyway, not a mystery. Well-established corpus of knowledge about the Yeti. Learn your facts, Bruni.
This will be the one thing that actually gets Frank Bruni demoted. Just that, like, his lack of knowledge of cryptids.
Also, is it actually estimated that Trump is worth $3 billion?
Nobody knows.
I don't think he's even worth $1 billion.
Zero people know how much money he actually has. Yeah. I mean, the way that
estimated based on what?
Yeah. What self-reporting is the thing. It's all self-reported.
I think what actually, unlike cryptids, I think what is well known is that Mayor Bloomberg is one of the richest fucks alive.
That is definitely known.
But I do love the
It's
fucking,
also known that he's a Republican.
But I love the brain, just absolute disconnection of the Clintons did this too during the campaign of he's not really that rich. It's like, dude, you're making people like him more, you fucking idiots. Like, people don't like rich people. Like, they like Trump in spite of the money. They liked it because the way that they thought he got it and the way that he presented himself and the fact that more than anything, and this is what all these idiots talk about, billionaires, like, billionaire versus billionaire, famous person.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That was it. He was a celebrity. He was on TV.
And I think Fran Lebowitz was right that she said that he acts like the way poor people think they would act if they got money.
Right. So they.
Well,
he's
more or less he's more or less like a celebrity rapist. Like that was what he was famous for.
Yeah.
He was like owning beauty pageants and like being in porn videos.
And, and that's cool for people. Well, they like that. It's relatable. It's like what they would do if they were rich.
Michael Bloomberg has a media presence too. He's the proud owner of not only the greatest financial trading terminal in the world, the Bloomberg terminal. He also. Founder and namesake of the world's third most popular, America's third most popular business channel, Bloomberg Network.
This is actually really funny. When my grandfather was still alive, and he was like read the Wall Street Journal every day kind of guy. And when Mayor Bloomberg was first running for mayor of New York City, and I was visiting my grandparents, he told me, "I'll tell you what, finest business news network in existence."
That's why he won, because America likes a
America
famous
loves
guy.
That shit.
A cool guy who's famous and has sexy TV shows like The Currency Hour on at 3:30 a.m. in the morning.
A really great way to look at all the stocks moving up and down, and it's a better screen for displaying it on than a regular screen.
American
that is cool.
Yeah, Americans like to get three screens, like Tank from the Matrix, and just look at all the markets go up and down, and they're like, thank you, Mr. Bloomberg, I love you. And he's like, you're welcome.
But I don't even see the yen anymore. I see blonde, 10.
That's what's so perfect about it, though, because they're saying, you know, it's a different. But every contrast is against him. It makes him less relatable. It makes him someone people are going to be less likely to want to vote for. He's a rich, prissy asshole from New York. But instead of, you know, being like a normal person would be like, yeah, I'm going to get rich and I'm going to get a fucking beauty pageant. I'm just going to hide in the girls' bathroom.
He's like, I'm going to create business terminals and a boring, because like, yeah, he had The Apprentice, and it's like, I'm going to have a boring channel for stupid financial news,
people,
and also I'm going to stop people
president.
From drinking soda. Stop what? Drinking soda. It's like they took Trump and put him
like
in a Ronco
Bloomberg,
food
it's,
dehydrator.
It's perfect Bloomberg versus snobs. They want the Porky's president.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
If Bloomberg like opened a casino and like went in a hot tub on TV, then maybe he could be president.
No,
can you imagine the Bloomberg casino? The Bloomberg casino would be so awesome. It's like using the Obamacare website. You just go into different risk pools. So tight, dude. I love it.
Yeah, I'm signing up. I could do Baccarat or I could do the slots for 15 minutes, and then I have to reapply for another group.
Oh, dude, I got so fucked up on Soylent at the credit derivative swap table.
No alcohol, no soda, obviously.
No smoking.
Yeah, no smoking. It'd be fucking great.
Versus,
but no, it's like
a nice room temperature glass.
It's like Trump
of water.
Is, my friend John LeConte pointed this out. Trump is big and wet, and Bloomberg is small and dry.
Yep.
Mm. He's like the beef jerky version of Trump, and everyone would rather eat a steak than beef jerky.
This is the Frank Bruni is saying that Bloomberg is the opposite of Trump. This is the clearly the distinction he missed. It's the only way Michael Bloomberg and Trump actually are dissimilar. Trump equals big and wet.
Yeah.
Bloomberg, short and dry.
Right, exactly.
Also, like, he's definitely not the opposite of Trump. Like,
no.
Not at all.
Not at all.
Just a prissy New York shithead.
He's going to go on here. He says,
who is the opposite of Trump? Like Maya Angelou?
I mean, I was going to say Oprah, but not exactly. But
yeah, not
more
really.
Effective.
Nah, not really. They got more in common than we do with her.
Yeah.
Tom Joad is the opposite of Trump. So Bruni continues here. To those of us who make do with fewer zeros and commas, that gap may seem meaningless, but you can fit the annual gross domestic product of North Korea in it.
Cool.
Another
awesome.
Really beautifully
awesome.
Written sentence.
Awesome.
And America falls in line to vote for this man.
Bloomberg, 76, probably doesn't stand a chance.
Oh, God.
He has all the va-va-voom of a ficus tree and all the populism of a Bermuda golf course.
Where does he get these goddamn comparisons?
These are the shittiest analogies ever. Like, no one has ever thought of, like, a golf course as the opposite of populism.
Yeah.
Like,
or a ficus tree
as
like, definitively boring.
Right.
Like if you were to think of when Bugs Bunny dressed up as a sexy lady, like the opposite of that is a fern.
Aren't ficus trees actually kind of like trendy right now?
I don't know.
Well, I have a fiddle leaf fig, so
yeah,
fiddle
leaf is what's trendy.
But if we're going to start putting Democrats' diverse options for 2020 on magazine covers, falling in and out in love with them, and
magazines where everyone gets their information.
Yeah.
If we're going to start putting all of them on magazine covers, falling in and out of love with them, and floating scenarios sublime and ridiculous, he warrants an iota of oxygen. An iota of oxygen. What an odd thing to write.
Wait, no. You buried the lead here. Falling in and out of love with them. Come on.
Just looking at a picture.
I remember when I fell in and out of love with the other guy who was in the debate. With the other
Lincoln Chafee.
Thank you. Yes.
No. That's accurate. I never
Hetty,
fell out of love
Hetty
with Lincoln Chafee. Thank you very much,
dude. I'm never loving a bitch again after Chris Dodd's betrayal of me in 2008.
I'm standing outside of Elizabeth Warren's bedroom with holding a boombox playing Peter Gabriel.
That is very sweet.
Well, this is a thing though that like libs do fall in love.
I mean, that's
with
true.
Their
he,
politicians
he's
and one
to
of their
libs,
one
so
of their. One of their big criticisms of like Bernie fans was like, you know, I get the impression they just like his policies. They don't really like him. And it's like, no, of course not. Of course not.
No,
he's a screaming old man.
No,
like
or,
we do like his
other
policies. We don't have like a weird libidinal kind of electra complex with Hillary Clinton.
No, but the other thing, the opposite of that was that there were so many people being like, how is it possible that an old screaming man could be so hip and trendy with young people? And it's like, because he's saying something good that is going to help them. Like, it's not because suddenly he is the definition of sexy or something like that.
Libs are personality cultists, but it's not just that. It's that they don't understand that other people are not.
I'm going to disagree with you slightly and say I do have a libidinal desire for Bernie Sanders. I want to make toast with him at his bomb-ass lake house. okay, so he goes... And he's hardly continuing of Bloomberg, he says, he warrants an iota of oxygen, a small pocket of the breathlessly speculative space that Corey and Kamala and Elizabeth and Beto are taking up. And that's not just because he's a serious person of stratospheric accomplishment. His name is synonymous. His name is synonymous with excellence, Nancy Pelosi recently said. His name is synonymous with excellence.
How old is Frank Bruni?
Not that old.
He's not that old.
Yeah, probably his 40s.
Stratospheric.
What? Stratospheric accomplishment.
You made a really good terminal. You guys have never used it, clearly. It's really good. It's a great terminal.
He's also, from a certain angle, the Trump deplorer's dream come true, an answer to prayers for the president's opposite. If there's a Michael in the mix with a few too many of Trump's qualities and the wrong temperature for the job, it's Avenatti. Not Bloomberg.
Michael Avenatti is
awesome.
So much cooler than Michael. I will say he's a lying scumbag, obviously. Like, he's a weird scam artist type of guy. But also, like, he fucking rules. He's like he looks like Johnny Sins.
He does.
Just like, you know what sealed the deal for me was when he locked his account with 764,000 followers. Like, to fight 4chan or something. That was just when I was like, this guy has one of the most powerful brains I've ever seen. If you want to talk about someone being like Trump, it's Avenatti. Being like Trump in the way that will let you win, because he has the Trump thing where he's like, just anything that happens, anything people say about him, he's like, yeah, no, it's not true. I can't be embarrassed. It's impossible to make me feel shame or embarrassment. And, like, you know, really, if you're going to do, like, a total head-to-head thing like that, not based on policies, Avenatti would be your guy, because he's the only one that can counter that.
Also, Avenatti actually seems to have some kind of passion for justice, like, of some sort. Like, he actually seems to be riled up on behalf of, you know, getting justice for his clients. Or, I mean, like, Bloomberg has never been fighting for anything other than...
Yeah, Bloomberg is
bloodless. Right.
Yeah, because for most people, the only person that they see on television directly appealing to them on those levels is a personal injury attorney. I will fight for you against evil insurance companies and your boss and stuff like that.
Michael Avenatti,
they're not getting it from politicians.
Michael Avenatti is also like, he's literally the only candidate in the Democratic field who I could see like actually achieving M4A if he actually did it. Because not because he like really gives a shit about anyone, but because I believe that he has that Lyndon Baines Johnson personality disorder where he's like, I'm going to perform this great act. I'm going to accomplish this great thing just to show that I am the only one who can do it.
He knows how to fight. That's the bottom line, right? Like, that's
for
what
you.
Hasn't been happening.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, in the manner of a personal injury lawyer.
President Jimmy McGill. It'll be great.
You said that Avenatti has the Lyndon Johnson personality disorder. That's also known as having a really big dick.
Huge dick.
Probably.
Avenatti has BDE.
Yeah.
But I'm also against that whole concept. So.
You're against the concept of BDE?
Yeah, I think it's completely insane that like in this moment, this Me Too moment, that anyone would ever start talking about like big dicks as like a positive thing. Like, this is just not needed right now.
Yeah, I disagree.
You need to keep your like big dick energy. It needs to just like dissipate and like linger away. Like,
disagree. Hard disagree.
I mean, really? Okay.
Big hard disagree.
Okay.
I mean, it's not new really. Like, our culture, like every culture, is always lionized big dicks. Like, you remember when Michelangelo statues with those huge dicks on them?
I remember
that. Just dragging along the ground.
Just huge, like something that like barely anyone would be that big ever.
I guess I'm saying for women, like, I don't think that women should be aspiring to have big dick energy, because I don't think that it's the right way of, you know, like, I feel like that's a very outdated mode of feminism that was big in like the early aughts, where it was like, I know, like, we're all just going to act like dudes and be disgusting like dudes and, you know, want to fuck all the time like dudes. And it was like, well, we didn't really like get many victories for. I'm challenging Amber to respond.
I mean, obviously I'm opposed to women imitating men unless, you know, they do it really well and it's hot. But I think that it's just kind of a flip thing that, you know, the kids are talking about online because it memes well.
Right.
And also, I can't figure out the targets that they're choosing to describe people as big dick energy.
Yeah, it doesn't quite make sense.
Pete Davidson is dying. He's dying. He's dying before our eyes. I don't know. Like, I don't know that you could say that there's something inherently threatening about it, because that man is on death's door, and someone should do something. He looks terrible.
It's all Pete Davidson and the ginger from this new Star Wars movie.
Yeah, like, those aren't particularly threatening representations of masculinity.
That if we're celebrating big dicks, we should celebrate small dicks, and we shouldn't like make big dicks be, like, feel
no,
so
we
special.
Got the Stavros in the house.
I believe in the synthesis, Harveyism. Think like a lady, act like a man.
Yeah, okay.
I was wondering where you're going with that, Felix.
Yeah,
and I just started sweating. I just started cold.
Oh, we're not
sweating.
Live. It's fine, dude.
Let's just, you know, synthesis. Just average dick, good feelings, good times for everyone.
Yeah, that's the Hegelian way to go.
Yeah, no, exactly. Let's go back to average penis length, 3 inches.
The artistic ideal.
Just like, you know, slightly too big, but it's okay.
Back to Bruni.
Back to this morsel.
The dick digression.
Bloomberg is as insistent on order as Trump is on disorder. Whoa, as steady cool. as Trump is spastic. Should not have used the word spastic there. That's problematic.
He's canceled.
Yeah, canceled. Frank Bruni's canceled.
Like,
Trump won't give us a moment's peace. Bloomberg could lull us to sleep. Politically speaking, we need the REMs.
Yeah, like,
what are
ether.
You talking about?
Like ether. Lots of things lull you to sleep that
That's
are not
what's
good.
Be. People, like, people across America are like, I love my boring, organized Jewish president. Like, that's exactly what they want.
Crying over the coffin. I love my manly Jewish president son.
Look, I just want a president who will wheel me into a room and show me nice pastoral images while pumping fentanyl into my veins.
Yeah.
And then just grinding me up into fucking bone meal.
Soothe me.
Also,
to
both
sleep.
Trump and Bloomberg don't have like real party affiliations. Like, they're just rich guys from New York. So is that what Bruni's saying we need? Like, that's a good thing that we should just have another completely amorphous, like, person who doesn't believe anything.
I don't think he's saying that, but I think he's picking up on it, but not smart enough to figure out that's the similarity he's recognizing.
Mm-hmm.
Bloomberg is as prepared as Trump was unready. The presidency for him wouldn't be a first whirl at governance. Some gee whiz, why not, how hard can this be, lark. He spent 12 years from 2002 through 2013 as New York's mayor, in charge of a complicated city of more than 8 million people. Trump operates by gut. Bloomberg demands data and more data.
More data, yes!
Facts.
Really, he didn't really seem to care too much about data when it came to stop and frisk.
Nope.
or when he sent, like, helicopters to break up Occupy, like, with, like, you know, cops and, like, Star Wars outfits.
Do you remember what Mayor Bloomberg said during Occupy, like, when people were in Zuccotti Park? He said, I don't know why they're protesting bankers. He's like, bankers... You know, they give you checks. They make $40,000 a year. He was literally said
that
they were protesting bank tellers.
Well, I was.
Yeah, I hate going to the bank, dude.
They're fucking. I don't
That's
like the way they
bullshit,
look at me,
man. Why can't I take the pen?
You
don't trust
down,
me enough to not chain
me.
That shit to the fucking table? Fuck you.
That'd be awesome going to Occupy Wall Street, but just because, like, your local bank didn't let you charge your phone in the lobby. Oh, what the fuck, dude? I've been thinking about being a customer, but honestly, fuck you.
They sent a free calendar for every account open, and that shit was fucking mini. That was a mini calendar for a fridge. That was not, that's a fucking falsehood.
Trump doesn't really have his hand on the wheel. He just wants to be the shiny hood ornament. Bloomberg is all pinpoint GPS navigation.
Oh my God.
This is the second.
Bloomberg is us, Garmin.
You've read us just two of these like unflavored bowls of grits in like the past month. And he's used the hood ornament analogy in both of them. He loves them. He loves a car analogy.
He didn't always steer New York in the right direction, but there was never any question that he'd keep us out of the ditch.
Cool.
There's a lot of New Yorkers in ditches right
now. Is this
like literally
an endorsement of Bloomberg?
Yeah.
Well, no, it's the implicit assumption here, and this is something that Felix talked about, is how many people who just want things to be normal again. Mm. They don't care if things get better. Mm-hmm. That because they're doing fine. They fucking subscribe to the New York Times. They just don't want to be bothered by the news anymore. They don't want to worry that the president's unstable. So they just want
and it means something to them what Nancy Pelosi says about someone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like they want this elfin technocrat to just steer us into the fucking iceberg that is rapidly melting. And we'll all die anyway, but at least we won't hear about it until it happens.
Trump is playing midwife to ever more extreme debilitating partisanship.
What?
This sense of metaphor is so boring yet gross.
What rough
Trump? Trump just breastfeeding a newborn. Oh, we love it.
Of partisanship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just a screaming black demon baby of partisanship. What just fucking Damien sucking on
the
Trump's
afterbirth
tits.
Of voter unrest.
Yeah. Trump is eating the placenta of polarization. Very cool, Frank.
What rough partisanship.
Also,
it's our come
I'm
at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born.
I'm just as offended as calling Trump a midwife as by Trump always saying witch hunt, because it's like where he sees himself as a witch, which is like completely offensive for him to identify as a witch. Yeah, please.
Magic.
We love it.
Is not for Trump.
Thank you.
Me and my girls
Bushwick
drinking wine.
Are gonna like
I'm like,
come
when's
with torches?
The last time you read tarot cards?
Me and my wonderful friends are drinking wine and watching The Craft. Oh, we love it.
I could have had Fairuza Balk in 1992.
Okay, they're going out there right now, but I'm light as a feather, stiff as a board.
Like, these are wonderful crystals.
Follow my peach if you think you know me well, okay?
Folks, the bones, I found them at the graveyard. They're amazing.
The future is
female. I'm conjuring so many spirits.
All right, everybody, I'm doing a thread about toxicity in the Tumblr witch community. Okay, look.
It's a special very Tumblr. Bad. It's a very special Tumblr.
How could it's hard to envision Bloomberg doing the same, meaning creating extreme debilitating partisanship. How could he demonize Republicans, independents, or Democrats when he has been a Republican, an independent, and a Democrat?
So has
and
Trump.
So is yes. Yeah. Yes.
Trump was a Democrat when you do
the
that.
Also, Republicans should be demonized. They're literal demons.
It seriously, does like what? That I mean, does Frank Bruni not know that?
Probably not.
Like parties love it when they do that too. They really think someone's a really reliable
also,
investment
Trump
when they bounce around from party to party.
Trump isn't like midwifing partisanship. He's like,
no,
he's letting out like white nationalism. Like it's not, you know, it's not like this is this bizarre thing where these people just like continue to fetishize some notion of like agreement where, you know, there's this like wonderful middle where we can all be with Bloomberg and Pelosi and
yeah,
everyone
but even
together.
The people too, you know, in the sort of general right aren't big fans of him. Like he's such a failure on any level to meet any of
Bloomberg
the standards.
Has no fans.
Yeah, no, exactly. He has no fans. He has no fans.
And while that may make him appear as ideologically rudderless as Trump, he's not. Many of his core positions and principles, pro-immigration, pro-choice, in favor of free trade, in support of clean air, have been intact for a long while. I love that that's one of Bloomberg's like well-known policy positions. I love clean air. I breathe it all the time.
I breathe it in my hyperbaric chamber under my dungeon every day.
Bloomberg doing the Trump steaks promo, but for air. I breathe air all the time. It's one of my favorite gases.
He's also just basically talking about the smoking ban. That's his contribution to clean air.
Oh, yeah,
it's
yeah,
ruining
yeah.
everyone's fun.
He's pro-transparency, too. When he was in government, he routinely released his tax returns. Though
gives a shit about the fucking tax returns.
Again, this is nerd shit.
Oh
this is what nerds think people care about.
I'm glad that the man who hoards $50 billion like didn't obtain any of it illegally. That makes me feel good.
It's also just so it's so weirdly like it's like clean air. It sounds like a Don DeLillo like satire of like a platform that someone would have. It's like my new terminal and my clean air and my like efficient release of tax returns. Like that's going to make people really passionate about you.
That's what New York Times people are passionate about.
Right.
And
right.
They have never met anyone else.
Right.
Though his station was well below the presidency and there weren't rampant suspicions about untoward influences on him and sinister conflicts of interest, he has had complaints about journalists, but he has never sought to delegitimize journalism itself. He never would. He owns a media company.
Cool.
He thinks that's good. He's like, yeah, of course. Why would he try and delegitimize it? He owns them.
He owns a media company that literally employs Eli Lake and Meghan McArdle.
It's like, it's so telling too. Like, I know that it's like tough to be a journalist, but not this type of journalist.
Yeah.
Like, it's very telling when like op-ed writers are like, yeah, Trump's so bad, he demonizes immigrants, black people, and journalists. And it's like, it's very sneaky to get that one in there. I almost didn't notice.
They all think they're Kim Wall.
Yeah, no, they're acting
and they
like
might end up dying in a submarine, but that's kind of it.
It's amazing. They act like a shitty op-ed journalist who, like, maybe once, like, in 2009, Trump was like, he was very unfair to me, like, is, like, we're being attacked. This is literally like living under Duterte. Like, Jesus Christ.
Well, like, soon I won't be able to publish my food reviews.
Yeah, that's
restaurant.
Pretty much,
He built that company from scratch without noteworthy melodrama. Trump got into real estate.
Oh, my God. So boring.
Trump got into real estate courtesy of his father, who gave and lent him large amounts of money. And as he sought to grow that fortune, he sprouted lawsuits and bankruptcies like weeds.
Wait, so it's like, okay, so now that Frank Bruni has slipped this in like 3/4 of the way down in his column, it's finally going to take hold. Like someone's going to read it and be like, wait a minute, you're right. Trump didn't start his company and he wasn't a self-made man.
Bloomberg is fanatical about recruiting top-notch talent and empowering it. Trump picks a mix of standouts and stooges and disempowers them, if they're lucky.
He gave Tito Ortiz a lot of chances on The Apprentice, actually.
If they're not, he disembowels them. Ask Jeff Sessions, who probably considers Mel Gibson's end in Braveheart preferable to his endless mortification.
Prayers up for Jeff Sessions.
Being
mistreated.
If Jeff Sessions did end up like William Wallace, I would pay to watch that on Bloomberg TV.
Like his example of someone being unfairly treated poorly is Jeff Sessions. Amazing, dude.
Is the neo-Confederate
fucking
golem.
Amazing. This fucking League of the South little goblin elf. Oh my God. This dark elf from World of Warcraft. Oh God.
Bloomberg's top aides say that with him, loyalty is a two-way street. With Trump, it only goes in one direction.
Oh, like a one-way street.
That's what you're thinking of, buddy. The one-way
he's literally
street.
Just saying, like, he's like, Trump is a sociopath. Like, Bloomberg has some regular human qualities. Like, so do a lot of other people. Like, he's just, you know, it's like he's comparing, he's saying Trump is only loyal in one way. Like, yes, because Trump is a freak who's different from, like, all other people. That doesn't mean Michael Bloomberg is the answer. Doesn't mean that this guy who happens to have, like, the normal way of relating to people in an organization, like, is the right answer.
Yeah, that's not a rare quality.
Right, exactly. It's like, almost everyone else has that quality.
Bloomberg's mayoral administration was light on ethical scandals. Trump's presidential administration, why even waste the keystrokes? Good question,
well,
Frank.
Well, you already wasted so many telling us.
Why stop now, Frank?
He's like, oh, man, I already put so much energy into this one analogy about how Michael Bloomberg is like the produce section and Donald Trump is the frozen food section. He's like, I can't even expend any more energy. I'm fucking beat,
he's
dude.
He's like, Bloomberg's children are polite and nice. Trump's children, well, need I tell you that there are three of them and four. Yes.
I hate the little...
His margins are really wide. Frank Bruni widens his margins.
I love Frank Bruni's, like, when he gets, like, his wry, devil-may-care style of prose. Very cool, Frank.
He's like Bloomberg never raped any of his ex-wives. Trump, on the other hand, has been accused of it.
Trump is a Potemkin philanthropist. Much so that a Washington Post reporter, David Fahrenthold, won a Pulitzer Prize for exposing all the fakery in the Trump Foundation. And the attorney
stopped him from being president.
Is this article aimed at someone who has not been living like in our society for the lately?
Yeah. Yeah, all Frank Booty's columns are like, all right, Frank, there's this guy who was recently brought out of a coma but lost a quarter of the function of his brain. We need you to tell him what's going on. And Frank's like, I can either give him the long version or say no more. And they're like, cool, Frank, don't ever fucking talk to me, the doc. I don't want to talk to you at all.
A guy wakes up from a coma and they're like, they take in Frank Bruni to be like, fill him in. And he goes, well, 10 years ago, we had Steve Jobs, Hope, and Johnny Cash.
Oh, my, yeah.
So he goes, Bloomberg is the real deal. Supporting a carefully chosen array of causes genuinely dear to him. What, like the New York Philharmonic?
Clean air.
And like,
exactly, yeah, it's all the fucking rich bullshit he likes anyway.
8 years ago.
Also, I'm sorry, Trump is very much the real deal in that he believes whatever he is saying at that particular moment.
Yeah.
Every charity that a guy like Michael Bloomberg supports is like, yeah, it's like the opera or it's adding a new wing onto Yale. And then every once in a while they do something where it's like, oh, we're sponsoring 30 inner city kids in a way that would actually benefits like 0.01% of the children it could benefit if I was just taxed at a more fair rate.
Yeah. 8 years ago, he signed the Giving Pledge, by which nearly 200 billionaires around the world have agreed to donate more than half of their wealth. In the last 2 years alone, he gave away more than $1 billion. Okay, yeah, I want to say something.
Out of 50.
Yeah, I want to like, say one thing about this idea. Like, we hear this with Bill Gates a lot. Like, he's pledged to give away all his money. Jeff Bezos just did this, where it's just like, he's going to give away all his money when he dies. First, or like a portion of it. First of all, giving away $1 billion when you have 50 of it means nothing.
Yeah.
It's bullshit.
Trump change.
And again, Amber asked the right question. Who's he giving it to? The answer is in almost every instance. They're giving it to a foundation their name. They're giving it to a foundation that they set up to appropriate the wealth that they're giving.
And that most of the work and energy within that foundation goes to running and maintaining the foundation.
Exactly.
So, like, yeah. And this is the other thing that they're not addressing, that Frank Bruni is not addressing in this article, is like the reason Bloomberg didn't join the 2016 race is because he wasn't meaningfully different from Clinton and he didn't want to divide the vote that would have gone to Clinton and risk having Trump win. But Trump won anyway. But still, now it's like, why would someone who's essentially no different from Hillary Clinton win?
But what about this other dry nerd that no one
it's
likes?
Like, he might as well say, what about Hillary Clinton to beat Trump in 2020? You know,
exactly.
Like that's literally how trapped in the...
Well, he has one advantage over Hillary Clinton, and that is his passionate defense of Charlie Rose.
Which no one asked him about, but he got right into it.
That's my favorite thing he's done as part of this PR blitz. It's just
say,
like,
you know what? He sticks up for his friends.
Yeah. It's just no one asked him about it, and he's like, you know, Me Too has gone too far. Honestly, like, my friend Charlie, we didn't think he did anything wrong. What's up?
Is Charlie Rose still going to start his talk show where he only interviews men who have been Me Too'd?
Because that was a real thing.
That was a trial balloon. I don't know if that's actually
I'm
happening.
For it. I'm trying to float that balloon back up into the air because I think that's the best thing for everyone. Because
they're like, people a YouTube.
Say, oh, is Louis going to come back and be like, you could be like, yes, he's going to be on Charlie Rose's Me Too Exile talk show next week. You know, like it would just be the perfect launching pad.
Well,
also,
network
like,
executives.
Who would go on that?
Everyone.
Well, none of them would agree. Anyone who ever wanted to come back would be like, no, I'm not going on that.
No, you would have to. It would be mandated. That's part of your rehabilitation.
Oh, so it's like, okay.
The first thing is you have to go on the show. Sure.
It's creative sentencing.
I'm currently pitching to networks my Me Too Takashi's Castle idea, where whoever completes the obstacle course gets to return to entertainment.
American Me Too Warrior.
Yeah.
Me Too Double
Dare. Oh, my God. That's...
Oh, wait, didn't the Double Dare host actually get...
I don't morally agree with the idea, but it's just like, you know,
ideas shared on a podcast are intellectual property and cannot be stolen.
Ah, shit, good call, Will.
We covered our ass in that one.
Oh, thank you.
So Bruni, actually, he gets into some criticism of Bloomberg here. He goes, he has gaping blind spots, which were described in a recent story about his potential candidacy by my Times colleagues Alexander Burns and Sidney Ember. I was floored that he digressed in an interview with Burns to wonder about the accusations against Charlie Rose.
It's like, I was floored that he was a 76-year-old man.
Yeah.
Although though Bloomberg, during his mayoralty, famously rode the subways, he never managed to seem of the subways.
I think he's kind of a mole person. You know, I think he's like a little bit rat-like.
Bloomberg just gets on the subway. Attention, ladies and gentlemen. I'm out here trying to do something positive for New York City. It's showtime. It's the time for the show. It's the time for the show, everybody.
Bloomberg does showtime, but it's just reciting U.S. dollar exchanges to other foreign currencies. Like, everyone's like, yeah,
even
go.
Bloomberg look, I'm out here. I am not selling drugs. I am not gangbanging. I am making a decent listening.
I'm trying to imagine Bloomberg doing like the showtime style tumbling, like, through the subway car, but like his version of that is just sort of sitting down and then standing up again. And he's like, ta-da!
I can't wait till Bloomberg goes on Ellen and Dabs. It's going to be the greatest day of my entire life.
Bloomberg's candidacy began with the change he got in return for all the cans he collected while living underground.
Bloomberg got arrested for stealing all those decommissioned MTA buses.
He never managed to seem of the subways.
Of the subways.
But then the 2016 election has left me confused about who should, could, and does have the ability to connect with middle-class and blue-collar Americans.
Hey, let me him. He'll do it.
Many of them saw a champion in Trump. It's funny. Republican voters came to embrace Trump, and then Republican lawmakers meekly followed suit, though he hadn't done all that much for the party before. Democratic voters are probably less inclined to embrace Bloomberg, but he has pumped substantial sums of money into initiatives regarding gun control, LGBT rights, climate change, and more that matter to them. That doesn't make him their best choice. It certainly doesn't make him their likely one. But I hope it elicits their respect and, if he pursues this thing, an open-minded assessment. So many of the virtues lost on Trump are found in him. Let's celebrate that as a way of making sure that the party's eventual nominee possesses them in robust measure.
The only qualities that I like about Trump are missing in Bloomberg.
Yeah.
Doesn't there an article about how he's a horrible sex creep and like harasses?
Bloomberg?
Yeah.
We should probably, you know, just to not get sued, but if you had to guess.
There was a whole article about like his treatment of his underlings and stuff. And one of the stories is like a woman, one of his underlings told him she was pregnant. He said, kill it.
What?
Yes.
Well, he has always been staunchly pro-choice.
He's pro-choice, yeah.
It does appear that Bloomberg has been met with a lot of pregnancy discrimination clauses.
Yes, yes, I was not correct. In 1996, four women sued him. One of them alleges that when she told him she was pregnant, one of his underlings, he said, quote, kill it.
Okay.
Cool guy. Real cool guy.
Very chill.
Ember, you said all the qualities that you like about Trump are absent in Bloomberg.
Yeah.
I just want to go into a little bit about Trump being a really cool guy this week. He gave a press conference at the UN earlier this week, and he had some pretty good quotes to come out of that.
Wait, I was hoping, though, that you were going to talk about the thing that he said in West Virginia at his rally about how he talked to some miners and he said, do you want to be making little delicate computer parts? And they said, no, I want to be mining coal.
Sir, I want to die for you. Yeah, you filthy little hogs. You love being dirty. You love it. Yes, sir, I love you.
You know, he went through a like McDonald's drive-thru in a mining town. It was like, I'm talking to miners.
Yeah, there are more vloggers than miners in America, by the way.
Absolutely, 100%. Yeah,
unfortunately.
Trump says a top expert on China, Michael Pillsbury.
Come on.
I want to know more about Michael Pillsbury. He says Michael Pillsbury went on a good show he won't name. It was Tucker Carlson's. And said,
he said, mm-hmm.
I'm reading
my wonderful friend, good friend Teddy Bear.
This is Daniel Dale, by the way. He always has the best tweets of Trump's press conferences
how he's not
and rallies.
Insane by now, I do not.
So
understand.
He goes here. He went on a good show and said China has total respect for Donald Trump's very, very large brain.
Okay. Let's
see,
just,
now, if like, this person weren't in charge of absolutely anything, and, you know, maybe didn't have that nasty, horrible mean streak, this particular free association style of communication would be charming.
Well, we had decades of that when Trump wasn't president, but was just like a famous crazy person.
Yeah, but he was still molesting people.
Well, okay, so that's true. That's true.
Just but this quality.
But I'm
is
saying,
fun
like,
for
what
us.
About just the fact that he always talks about himself in third person? Always. Like, no one even comments on it anymore. But, like, other presidents didn't do that. They didn't always call themselves by their own full name.
Let me be
Bob
clear.
Dole.
Obama
Bob Dole
is
did.
Gay.
Do you remember?
What?
Bob Dole did. Oh, yeah.
Bob Dole? Yes, Bob Dole. Bob,
and it was insane.
Him for it.
We
Bob
all Dole. Made fun of him for it.
Bob Dole, I'll tell you right now, Bob Dole, he's going to be a good president. He's so very tired, but Bob Dole wants to be a president so bad.
But maybe it is just like when you achieve what Trump has achieved, which is like full media consciousness focused on you at all times, 24 hours a day globally, like you are not I anymore. Like
right.
you are
he,
a thing
he,
that
he
is
watches
Donald
himself
Trump.
On
right.
TV.
Like he is relating like, to Donald Trump.
He
the
is
way
his own
the
favorite show now. Right.
Donald Trump did the ending of Deus Ex where J.C. Denton merges with the AI, with the supercomputer, but for his favorite thing, the news. It's like his dream. He lives forever as the news.
Here's another thread.
Being of pure news, though.
He's Dr. Manhattan of the news.
It's true.
He is.
It's 1983. I see Cheryl Teagues, and oh boy, real nasty attitude. But yeah, could have had her, actually. Bought her an ottoman. They're just on Mars, and they're suffocating. Oh, sorry.
Here's another thread with Trump that I've loved recently. His ongoing bromance with Kim Jong-un.
I know.
Yeah. He literally said,
"We're in love."
We're in love. He said, "We love each
we
other."
Love.
Kim Jong-un is in my triad. Wonderful.
No, but he said, this is back to Daniel Dale. At the UN, he was asked why he needed a second summit with Kim Jong-un so soon. Trump said, "Because he'd like it."
I just miss him. I just miss him so much.
Trump says Kim's letters are magnificent in that they convey a desire to get things done. He complains of what somebody on a TV network he won't name said about this yesterday.
I think Kim Jong-un has a way clearer head than Donald Trump. We can all agree on that.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely. Before Trump came along, everybody in this room thought you were going to war, Trump tells journalists who did not universally think there would be a war.
That's Trump, my favorite new thing he's doing, where he's saying, Obama, he was gonna have a nuclear war with North Korea. I stopped it. That's his new thing. It's amazing.
But then I also said I would do that. But then I didn't. I stopped it. I prevented it.
Trump says he and Kim Jong-un both smile at and laugh at their previous harsh rhetoric about each other.
Oh, remember when we
That's
hated
sweet.
Each other?
Isn't that nice?
Perfect strangers.
Oh, totally, yeah.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah. You know, hate turns to love. They have the same body type.
They do. They got a lot in common.
Little Humpty Dumpties.
And like,
do you think that Donald Trump Jr. is jealous of how much Trump Sr. loves Kim
Jong-un?
Totally.
Oh, absolutely.
Totally.
Because he is like, look at this guy. He's a real self-starter. He took over. He's young. He's like,
he's not
always
a loser.
Complimenting
he's not a
see,
loser.
That's what a son is, folks.
Yeah, exactly.
That's someone who takes over. You see, his dad, he didn't have to get his idiot Jewish son-in-law to take over because he didn't trust his real kid. His kid was good. He's doing a great job.
This is actually, I think this is my favorite thing from the UN press conference. Just in like the live tweeting of it, it says, Trump calls up a questioner, then says, this is the one that was nodding at all the nice things he said. She says it's just a habit of hers when listening.
I just love the idea. Everyone moving their heads like they're all saying yes, yes. Like he thinks that people are saying boo urns. He did that at the UN. They laughed at him, and then he goes, oh, they were laughing with me.
He literally
we're all
said,
having a great time.
He literally said they were laughing out of respect.
That famous thing you do when you respect someone is laugh at their claims.
Asked if he's concerned about the message he's sending to women watching by using the phrase con job, Trump interrupts and says, I've used much worse language in my life than con job. That's like probably the nicest phrase I've ever used.
I love it when he does that. Like, do you remember when like the first time they asked him about the Kavanaugh accusations? He's like, yeah, you know, I've been accused like 4 or 5 times.
And yeah, and he's like, everyone I know has been accused. Like yeah. All of his friends.
Like, oh, man. It's going to be tough voting for him again.
Oh, and then, of course, the other great moment from that press conference is when he called on a reporter, Mr. Kurd.
Mr. Kurd, yeah. Of course.
That's amazing.
That I'm Mr. Kurd's side, and she's calling in air, and she's striking the turf.
But also, they talked to Mr. Kurd, and Mr. Kurd was like, I loved it. Like they the person who he called Mr. Kurd genuinely was like, I felt so
well, yeah,
oh, we love it.
Because he... just without thinking about it, affirmed Kurdish claims to control of northern Syria in the face of their NATO ally, Turkey.
Dude, Donald Trump is like, his brain swirls around enough a day, and he just like, it's like this spinning globe and the dart trick. Just sometimes it lands in like some weirdly left position. He's like, you know, I support Rojava. Wonderful. Like,
more and more people love the Kurds. I want to talk about Piss Pig Granddad. He's great. Well, he's great, folks.
Abdullah Öcalan, treated very unfairly by the Turks. Okay? Murray Bookchin, read him.
Like, you remember when he was like, he like accidentally was like, yeah, we should do debt forgiveness for Puerto Rico. And then, like, Steve Mnuchin tried to do the Valkyrie plot on him.
But that's just it. But then they realized, oh, he'll forget about it in 2 hours.
Exactly.
And that's the thing. And that's what makes this, it's always funny when he does this, but so frustrating to know that none of this means anything. Like, literally nothing he says means anything because the people behind him.
Or, no, yeah, another example of that was, remember how there was like a week when Trump, to get back at Jeff Bezos, started criticizing what Amazon has done to the post office?
Yeah,
and it was like,
yeah,
all of a sudden, oh, yeah, he was like standing up for the post office, yeah, kind of, you which really actually is a really good thing that should be happening. I mean, it is a good civic institution that we have a post office. He was doing, yeah, it in a completely insane way, but he was shining a light on something.
The thing
like
is, when you're motivated by spite and not ideology, at right some point, you're going to make the right enemy.
Yeah,
right.
That's true. No, absolutely.
Always bet on spite, baby.
But, sorry, but thankfully, motto, we've got guys... real patriots like Kelly and Mattis and Mnuchin to keep him on the straight and narrow.
Well, that it, fucking
barreling towards apocalypse.
That fucking article, the op-ed in the New York Times, the anonymous op-ed from the senior administration official who was fighting Trump's agenda from inside. When he said, "I'm fighting Trump's worst impulses," he meant things like that.
Yeah,
right.
He's like,
yeah,
the racism shit, I'm fine with it.
Right.
You bringing
manufacturing back to America?
Yeah,
it's
right,
done.
That was, he's like, we will not have manufacturing jobs back in the United States.
Yeah,
you will work in a fucking Denny's and you will fucking like it.
Wait, but that is such a crazy example. I literally completely forgot about that until you just said that. And like,
yeah, it was only like a million years ago.
It feels like a thousand years
ago. It was a huge deal.
It was a week ago.
Except that also there were these huge New York Times articles that were like, let's break down every possibility of who this might be. And I looked at it for 1 second and I was like, I'm so bored.
Yeah,
I don't
yeah
care. Like, actually, it's so boring. Anyone, unless it's Mike Pence, that'd be the only interesting answer, basically, because everybody else is just like, who cares? Like, there, I mean, yeah,
who's the Colonel von Stauffenberg in
right
the Trump administration?
Right.
I came up with a realization like that the other night, that Sons of Anarchy could also be an analogy for Never Trump Republicans. And in season 2, Zobel is Trump.
Mm.
Yeah,
because it's like in the previous season, the Sons of Anarchy do all the bad things, and they even deal with another Nazi in Brandon Darby. Mm-hmm. But then a Nazi,
and they're
comes,
racist. Like, you can't be black and join
so
the Sons.
They're so racist. Yeah. Like, Ron Perlman drops the N bomb constantly.
Yeah.
But then, like, the bad type of Nazi comes, and they're like, "Fuck this shit." I'm so yeah. No, today's a very freewheeling episode because we did a very like two very heavy Brett Kavanaugh episodes, and frankly, I've been watching Sons of Anarchy again, and I'm here for it. Yeah, yeah, if you know, like, a lot of bile out there, we got a lot of bile out, you're probably still feeling the bile, but we, you know, we want to talk about Trump's stupid brain and the bad articles and Jax Teller. Sorry.
All right. Well, Elena, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
But I'd also like you to talk about, I said at the very beginning of the show, you are a showrunner. You know, as a fellow showrunner myself, I would like to give you the opportunity to maybe tell us and our listeners about a cool new thing that is an Elena Smith production.
I'm not really allowed to talk about it and did not check with anyone whether it was okay to do any kind of promotion.
Well, we could say, you know, in broad outlines, in the broadest
broad strokes,
possible outlines.
I'm making a television show called Dickinson for Apple in their undisclosed location and how unknown how it will be released or when and in what way it will be beamed into your it will be dropped into your phones without your permission. No, I don't know. But Will came to visit me on set the other day. That mm-hmm. was pretty cool. And yeah, it's a show with Haley Steinfeld as Emily Dickinson. It's like nothing ever made. It's like nothing you would expect. It takes place in the 1850s, but in a kind of reinvented sense, and it's going to come out within the next 12 moons.
Well, I'm very looking forward to seeing it. The trip to the set was really fun, and I was really blown away by just how many people have to work to make something like this, yeah. like a TV show possible.
Because I'm a boss
yeah,
bitch.
Yeah. I was amazed.
We have one guy that works yeah. hard.
I was amazed at how professional everything was.
That's actually exactly what my mom said when she came to visit set. She was like, I just can't believe how many people are working for you on this thing.
Yeah, and like I was supremely
impressed. It's a union project, you know?
I was supremely impressed with Elena, who I've known for a little bit now, coming to see you there. And then you were literally like the General Patton. You had just yeah. like an army of people.
Basically, being
at your
a showrunner is completely awesome because you get to be in charge of everything, but you don't have to take responsibility for dealing with the actors, which is the hardest part. So you don't actually have to, like, you just get to say what you want and then make other people do it.
Yeah. So Dickinson, it is a sort of funny sort of historical period drama that is a funny kind of weird look at the life of Emily Dickinson,
yeah.
played by Haley Steinfeld, who yes. you may know as the great lead performance in the Coen Brothers' True Grit,
yep.
a film I really enjoyed. And I got to say, having
good
seen
in
her,
period clothes.
Having seen her in the clothes and in costume, she doesn't like look like Emily Dickinson, but like she looks like Emily Dickinson. You know what I mean? Like yep. I was really impressed by how cool everything was. And there's some other
Jane
tidbits.
Krakowski yeah. is Mrs. Dickinson. We have an amazing actor named Toby Huss, who is Mr. Dickinson. It's the show is being executive produced, and the first two episodes are directed by David Gordon Green, who did Eastbound and Down and Vice Principals.
You cannot get a better pilot director.
And I know that everyone hears all these elements and thinks that nothing could be more random, but it does make a kind of sense once you see, hopefully once you see the outcome. But so, it's very exciting, and we are making the whole season right now. So we're shooting 10 episodes in a row.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Is this Artie the Strongest Man in the World, Toby Huss? Does anyone remember the Adventures of Pete and Pete?
Oh, yes, you're correct. He was in Pete and Pete. Yes.
Oh, my God. Okay, brings it back to Gen X.
Oh, he's very Gen X. Yeah.
Well, if you want something to look forward to in the future, there's not much, but...
Yeah. I'll come back again when we can talk more specifically.
Big Dickinson
about
energy.
Big Dickinson energy.
Is one thing we can all look forward to sometime in the near future.
That's right. Elena we'll talk Smith. About authenticity, right? Yeah. Gen X hero.
Elena Smith. Thank you so much again for sitting in this today.
Thanks
and joining
for having
us
me.
This week. Till next time, guys.
Bye.
Have you seen Josephine? Someone from town like Marshall Brown or someone you know? Have you seen?